Well, welcome everybody to this GNDE, Green New Deal of Europe webinar. We've got a special guest, Nick Dearden, and Nick is one of the responsible people who contributed to the GNDE concentrates on the subject of trade, I believe, Nick. So welcome, and welcome everybody. If you could put your mics on mute for the time being while Nick gives us a bit of a background, and afterwards we'll have an open question session. Thanks. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks very much, and thanks for inviting me both to this, but also to contribute in the first place to the Green New Deal for Europe. When I first looked at the outline for the document, the one thing I really wanted to contribute was about solidarity, about making sure this was genuinely global and not simply a Eurocentric piece of work. And that's because obviously climate change is already having incredibly unfair impacts, if you like, at a global level. I mean, this is a crisis that's been fueled by quite a few societies in the world, quite a small number of societies. And of course, the heaviest burden is being faced at the moment by societies that by and large have not contributed towards it. So it's already exacerbating some of the terrible inequalities we see in the world today. And it's really important, I think, therefore, that the solutions that we design to this problem are genuinely global and take that into account and try to undo some of those inequalities. I was really struck recently because before my country left the European Union, I went to the European Parliament at the invitation of some of the Green MEPs, and we had a debate on trade, and there was somebody there from the wind industry. And he was saying, trade liberalisation is desperately important at the moment, because if we want to have this Green New Deal here in Europe, I need for the wind industry to be able to get my hands on these raw materials, these metals, and they by and large come from Africa or from China. And so we need trade deals to lock in our ability to access these metals. And I thought, wow, this is a very frightening development, because actually you've got here the use of what we would normally regard as a positive, dealing with climate change, a Green New Deal, in order to argue for terms of trade that are going to be deeply unfair, that perpetuate a kind of trade system that's been going for hundreds of years now, where we extract and take wealth and materials from the rest of the world in order to promote industry here. And if we're not really careful, this could become seen as part of the solution here in Europe, whereas actually we want to use climate change to critique the way that the world operates and these inequalities and so on. So then I thought this is even more important that we contribute and are very firm on some of these issues and actually try to think through ways that we can both make the world a fairer place and deal with climate change, and not use climate change rather to perpetuate these kind of inequalities in the global economy. So I'm going to focus specifically on trade, because I think it's in many ways at the heart of the global economy, but I'm very happy to talk about finance or aid or agriculture or some of the other areas mentioned in here as well, and the solidarity components of that. But trade, why? My organization has always been interested in trade and campaigning for fairer, radically different trade rules. But if you just look at the relationship between trade and climate change and trade and the environment, it's very clear that over the last 3-4 decades, the trade rules that we've got and the increase in global trade that's been a vital product of globalization and global economy has fueled climate change massively. It's massively increased our carbon emissions. Even free traders would recognize that and agree with it. Why? Because modern trade deals in the era of neoliberalism, you know, the system we've had since the late 70s, early 80s, doesn't regulate or constrain trade, doesn't regulate or constrain global corporations or investors. Rather, it embeds this idea that we need endless liberalization and endless growth. This is the solution that's embedded in trade deals and trade rules today. In fact, rather than constraining the economic actors, the big corporations and big financiers and investors in the world, rather the trade rules that we've got constrain governments and stop governments being able to act. And that's a real problem, because we need government action both to rebalance our economies for all sorts of reasons. I mean, we're living through a coronavirus crisis. We need government action in order to be able to deal with this crisis. Climate change is an even bigger crisis, and we desperately need government action to be able to mitigate and to hopefully halt climate change. And yet, trade deals prevent that in many ways. They've become a disciplining force on governments in the world. And rather, the expansion of trade for its own sake has become the goal of trade rules. And this is particularly worrying because trade rules are really very enforceable. So unlike all of the stuff we like and call for as civil society, rules on human rights and rules on climate change and so on to get us towards the better world that I'm sure we all agree we need, actually the goals of some of the most enforceable rules that we have in the world are all about expanding trade and expanding investment for their own sake, regardless of the consequences of that. In fact, the whole point of neoliberalism is really to shift the costs of the growth of the economy onto the environment, onto workers, onto other parts of the world, onto future generations. And this is a huge problem, not least, of course, because when you have an economy which is based on fossil fuels, both to transport stuff around the world, but also just to make stuff, the idea that making more and more and more stuff and transporting that stuff further and further is going to do anything but be a disaster for climate policy is a nonsense. So it's really built and hardwired into the form of trade rules and regulations that we have today. Now, partly this is down to what we traditionally think of as trade policy, tariffs, which we talk about in the Green New Deal for Europe document. So for sure, the stripping away of the ability of southern governments to use tariffs and subsidies has been a complete disaster when it comes to their southern countries being able to support infant industries and thereby rebalance their economy. It's also been a complete disaster, particularly when it comes to agriculture. I mean, many countries in the world have their agricultural policies really very strongly constrained by international trade rules that say you shouldn't support your farmers, you shouldn't subsidize your farmers in the way that they were used to doing in the 1960s and 70s. You should let the free market work its magic. This is the best way to distribute agricultural products around the world. And of course, when you throw small farmers onto the mercy of the market, it creates complete crises in their livelihoods, and especially when you force them to compete against massive multinationals producing at industrial scale from the West. I mean, you just can't compete. So the whole growth of industrial agriculture over the last 40 years as part and parcel of these trade rules and the disciplining of southern governments to prevent them being able to behave in the way that our own governments behave, actually, but certainly our own governments have behaved in the past. This has been a disaster. But actually, an awful lot of what appears in modern trade deals is probably not what a lot of people would think of as trade policy. Actually doesn't have a lot to do with tariffs. People think of trade as being about kind of tariffs and quotas. An awful lot of what appears in modern trade rules and modern trade deals is not about tariffs. Increasingly, it's about what are called non-tariff barriers. And non-tariff barriers are, what are they? How do you sum up non-tariff barriers? Well, it's regulations, essentially. It's anything which, say I'm an exporter from another country and I want to export stuff into your market, any rules and regulations that prevent me doing this or make it harder for me to do this, I can label as a non-tariff barrier. And then I can persuade my government, when you enter trade negotiations with this country or when you go to the WTO to challenge this country, you want to challenge these rules that are preventing me exporting into this market. What do they look like in practice? Well, in practice, many of these rules and regulations, of course, are not set up as any kind of great protectionist. This is about protecting our own markets from someone else's markets where they make things equally well. They're the standards that we have fought for years and decades in order to create a better economy within our own country. So let me give you some examples. At the moment, this country is talking about doing a trade deal with the United States. in a very similar way that the European Union was talking about a TTIP-style deal. And many of the aspects of that trade deal that people are most concerned about are exactly the same as the concerns expressed by people across Europe at the time of TTIP around our food standards. Right? Particularly these poor old chlorine chickens that have become very famous now all across Europe. And the chlorine chickens are really a symbol of something much deeper going on here, which is the United States produces food to a completely different standard to how food is produced in the European Union and in Britain. And it tends to produce stuff on a much bigger industrial scale. And part and parcel of that is worse animal welfare. Animals are kept in worse conditions. In order to keep them alive and growing in those conditions, you need to inject them with all sorts of steroids and hormones and antibiotics that we don't use by and large. Of course, we do use to some extent, but by no means the same extent they do in the United States. More genetic modification in the food chain, more antibacterial washes at the end of the animal's life to get rid of all the, rather than having a kind of what they call a farm to fork production method, where you look at the holistic way that the animal lives and dies and try to make that as clean and healthy as possible. Don't worry about any of that. You just dunk it in chlorine or bleach, some kind of bleach wash at the end of the animal's life to get rid of all the bacteria, and then it goes on to the market. It's a very different form of food production. And it's a form of food production where industrial, big business agriculture is far more dominant even than it is here. It's bad enough here, but even worse in the United States. But what the US is arguing in those trade negotiations is all of the food standards that you currently enjoy in Britain, that you've put into place over a number of years in Britain, these aren't democratically decided food standards, first and foremost. They are protectionist measures to keep our products out of your markets. And so our objective in trade negotiations with you is to get rid of those unfair, what they call unfair regulations and rules. So you will not be able to prevent these goods coming into your market because that's unfair and protectionist. So you have all sorts of good, the goal is you have all sorts of goods coming in that are made to lower standards coming into your markets. And then, of course, what do farmers here do? Because farmers here aren't allowed to produce to those standards. Well, they either have to go bankrupt or they have to argue with the government to lower standards here too, so that they can compete with these goods coming into your country. So in this way, trade deals today embed a kind of race to the bottom in terms of standards right across the board. I mean, people are concerned about food for obvious reasons. It's something we think about a lot as human beings, but it applies to all manner of economic sectors and industrial processes. And one of the big problems, and this causes problems across society, it causes a problem for workers' rights and workers' pay, it causes a problem for all manner of regulations. But when it comes to agriculture in particular, of course, this has a major impact on the environment. Because the more you go down a route of big business dominated industrial agriculture, the more you're taking out of the environment, the less you're working with the grain of the environment, if you're like sustainably farming and so on. So it's a huge issue, and it's one of the major issues that the EU rejected TTIP, and it's one of the big fights that we have to have here today. So non-tariff barriers, regulation, a very big part of contemporary trade deals and trade rules, but many other aspects too. I'll very quickly mention four that I think will be interesting for this conversation. First of all, modern trade deals tend to constrain how you can set up public services in your country. So healthcare services, transport services, stuff that's traditionally been run by the public sector. These are increasingly part of trade disciplines, trade rules, and they tend to push in favor of further liberalization. So they tend to make it more difficult, not impossible, but more difficult for governments to keep certain services public, keep certain services out of the marketplace. They have even special clauses called ratchet clauses, which are all about ratcheting up the liberalization of public services. This is a major issue when it comes to rebalancing economies and controlling the role of the market and constraining the role of the market over our society. Because if essentially, and I mean, we've had successive governments that have liberalized and privatized bits of our healthcare system. If you're then saying you can't undo that, essentially, that the only thing you can do is more privatization and more liberalization. This is a massive problem in terms of how a government can protect people and protect society. Not to mention, for the purposes of our conversation here, many of these public sector jobs tend to be lower carbon emitting jobs. And if we want to rebalance our economy so that it's not all about endless growth and market mechanisms, we need to have strong public sectors. That's inhibited by modern trade rules and modern trade deals. Some trade deals today, second thing I'll mention, try to create free markets in energy. This is an even bigger problem. I mean, NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, is a really good example of this, where essentially they try to create or gone some way towards creating a free market in energy. And what that means is that Canada has to export a proportion of the tar sands that it produces to the United States, which of course maintains a bigger market for tar sands and means more tar sands are dug up and produced. There are also energy neutrality clauses today that actually prohibit governments or make it more difficult for governments to discriminate between different sorts of energy sources. I mean, a complete disaster for dealing with climate change. How can you deal with climate change when you can't discriminate between different sources of energy? So it's a big issue. Thirdly, intellectual property. Some of what trade deals do today aren't really about the free market at all. They're about protecting corporate privileges and corporate monopolies. Intellectual property is a really good example of this. My organization, I was saying at the beginning, when we were getting to know each other, also works on pharmaceutical corporations. It's a big problem in terms of producing coronavirus vaccines at the moment. Trade rules that basically say, you know, companies that invent medicines then get protection for those medicines so that they can more or less set whatever price they want, whatever the market will bear for 20 years at least into the future. But the same thing applies to new technologies that we are inventing all the time to create lower carbon economies. I mean, if those things are also protected by patents, by intellectual property for 20 years plus, into the future, this hampers the ability of sovereign governments to be able to copy what we've done and create their own low carbon economy. So it prevents technology transfer. And fourth and final, and I think this is a really important point, trade deals today are not just about trade in goods and services, not even just about trade but also about investment. And when we say investment, what we really mean is removing obstacles to capital being able to go anywhere it wants in the world, behave anywhere, any way that it wants in the world without restraint from government. And these are normally incorporated in investment protection chapters. And at the heart of many of these investor protection chapters are something called ISDS. ISDS stands for Investor State Dispute Settlement. We call it a corporate court system, because essentially what it allows is any investor from the country that you're doing the trade deal with can sue your government or your public authorities for doing anything which that investor basically doesn't like, which anything that they say discriminates against them or is unfair or damages their bottom line. And it's very interesting. These things have existed in trade deals for quite a long time, but they're being used more and more and more. And so many of the cases involve challenging environmental protection. So there are many cases that we've come across, both from developed and developing countries. Canada is a special victim of these, actually, because of NAFTA. Again, it's challenged a lot by American investors. And so many of the cases that they fight are challenges about environmental protection. So an interesting case of Quebec, which was sued by a company called Lone Pine because Quebec put a moratorium on fracking because it says we want to look into the long-term implications of this. We don't just want you to go away with these, run away with these projects. And then they were successfully sued. And Quebec had to, I think it's still going on actually, what happens at the end is you have to pay out, essentially. You have to pay the investor for loss of profits. Canada was hit with another lawsuit from a company called Bilcon. It was building a quarry in Canada. And Canada was worried because Indigenous people were protesting and saying this is a site of particular significance and it will have a devastating impact on the environment. And they carried out an environmental assessment. And part of the ISDS case was a challenge to Canada's ability to even carry out that environmental assessment. They said even carrying out the environmental assessment was a violation of the standards that investors should have expected in your country. And even one of the people on the panel, it's normally only a few people can serve on these panels. You have to know a lot about investment law, and they're mostly corporate lawyers. And one member of the panel said, I'm very unhappy about this, because if this challenge is successful, it really does question our ability to ever have an environmental policy, to the tools of our environmental policy, the tools of our environmental sovereignty are challenged to such an extent that it's a really big threat. Unfortunately, it did go through and it was successful, and Canada had to pay out. I don't know if it's happened yet, Bill Conn. And then final example is a company called Uniper. It's a German company, I think, a German energy company. It has power plants that run all across Europe and maybe outside as well. Many of them rely on coal, as many of our power plants do. They, at the moment, are about to launch a case against the Netherlands because the Dutch government said they want to phase out coal power by 2030. And Uniper says, but that's our profit. That's how we make our profits. You're damaging our profits. You're treating us unfairly. We're gonna sue you for putting a climate target in place. And of course, one of the things this does is it means that it becomes a business model for the country, because they say, we'll just go ahead. We don't have to make any changes based upon climate science or what we think governments are going to do, because if they do it, we'll sue them. And that can be almost built into our economic model for continuing to behave in a completely irresponsible manner. So absolutely disastrous. And these things are being used more and more and more because there's loads of corporate lawyers, including here in London, who are persuading companies to take on these cases because they say, look, you can win. And now we're even seeing hedge funds investing in these cases to make it more likely the case will be able to go ahead and wear down the country. And so it's a growth industry, suing governments for environmental protection. So for all of these reasons, trade policy and trade deals and trade regulations are a massive obstacle to our ability to fight climate change, and we need reform and we need change. And there's some suggestions for that in the Green New Deal book. Let me just say a few words before I finish on the solutions. And first of all, I just want to look at it holistically, to take a step back and look at what's happened to climate, to trade policy in the last 30 or 40 years. You see, we've gone from thinking about trade rules as being something that regulates trade and constrains trade to being something that allows corporations to do anything that they want. It's actually interesting, if you go back to the post-war settlement and the Havana Charter that was signed to, well, basically set up a kind of World Trade Organization. It never happened at that point. It had to wait till the 80s. But it's a very interesting document because it says, look, sure, we believe in open markets, we believe in trade, in tariff liberalization, but, you know, when it works, when it's good for us, when it helps meet our major overarching goal in society, and after the war, that was full employment, because people looked at unemployment in the 1930s and said, well, that's what led to fascism and war and all the rest of it. So full employment, very important. Development for newly liberated countries who are throwing off the chains of empire, very important. So yeah, sure, open markets, by and large, we agree with that and we support it insofar as it meets these other goals. And if it doesn't meet these other goals, we won't do it. And there were all sorts of loopholes that countries could use to get out of opening markets and reducing tariffs if they didn't want to and they didn't think it was going to work in their interests. And we've gone from that to say, no, it is always and everywhere. In fact, it's so good, it's an end in itself. Don't worry if it produces full employment or good environmental policy or whatever. It's just good. It goes without saying. And this is a problem. And I think we've got to get back to thinking of trade as something that governments need. Trade rules need to be something which allow us to meet broader objectives in society. And that must not only encourage but mandate government action if that's not happening. And so for me, it's reformulating the whole basis of trade rules. And I think without question, we need to get rid of some of this investor stuff. I mean, ISDS just needs to go. I mean, it's just thoroughly undemocratic. And, to be honest with you, whenever you speak about this to any politician, anywhere on the political spectrum, they're normally horrified by it and don't know about it. So I think it's just awful and we need to get rid of it. I think we need to radically change intellectual property laws. I think the coronavirus crisis gives us some opportunity to talk about that, and climate change even more so, and begin to think about technology transfer as something that we can do to help other countries, to make up for some of our climate debt, if you like, and help other countries to develop in a cleaner way. It's going to benefit all of us. And to some degree, to reduce the scope of trade deals, right? So to stop thinking of trade deals as the be-all and end-all, you know, and actually just to reduce their scope and scale and ability to override government action. And I think one of the things we want to be really careful of over the next few years is you're going to hear a lot of stuff from governments, from neoliberal governments, talking about trade liberalization is the answer to climate change. Don't worry about what's happened in the past. We can put sustainability chapters into our trade deals, and that will make them absolutely wonderful and fit for purpose and help us to deliver our environmental goals and all the rest of it. We've got to be very, very cautious about this, because really, for me, trade liberalization is not the answer. That doesn't mean I'm somebody who's in favor of like throwing up tariff barriers everywhere we can find the opportunity to do one. It's not necessary that protectionism is a wonderful thing that's going to help us solve climate change, but we absolutely need a more balanced approach to trade, and we need to hand power back to governments, back to societies, so that they are able to put in place the measures that we need if we're going to sort out the tremendous problems we face in the coming years, whether that be climate change, whether it be inequality, whether it be our susceptibility to pandemics, whatever it is, we clearly the market has failed us. Any rules that enshrine the rule of the market over our societies needs very, very serious change. And I think that what we've put in the Green New Deal here is a good starting point. But actually, I think we're going to need to go much further. And I think this is a debate we need to have in society as a whole. And I found, interestingly, in this country, activists, of course, they love campaigning against the US trade deal because they're so angry about what it might mean for society here. But actually, they're really interested in talking about trade policy as a whole and talking about how we could design international economic rules that encourage cooperation, encourage collaboration, but do so in a way that allow us to take the measures that we know is needed. So I've gone on enough. I'll leave it there. But thank you very much for your time.
Wow. Jeepers, I'm sure we've got lots of questions. if anybody wants to say something, please either raise your hand. There's so few of us here, or stack in the chat so we can make sure everybody gets a chance to ask a question. Okay, Stephanie is just saying that she keeps getting kicked out of Zoom. Sorry about that. Okay, I have a question sort of regarding agriculture, and it's, I don't know how relevant it is, but I was listening to an interview with a Dr. Zach Bush in the States the other day, a podcast, and he said something that 4,000 farmers had been interviewed, and they'd come up with a timeline of how many harvests are left on this planet before the soil has lost its nutrient value with the current herbicides and pesticides. And he said that it's approximately 70 years. And that scared the bejesus out of me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Our whole agricultural system is such a disaster. And, you know, the idea that the answer is more of the same, if you like, more chemicals, more pesticides. And actually, we need to return. So we work a lot with the food sovereignty movement. Food sovereignty is a concept that's been driven by, well, peasant and small farmer movements around the world. They're obviously very strong in many countries in the world. They've got this concept of food sovereignty that yes, we should try to localize markets more. Obviously, you can't completely do that, and probably don't want to completely do that, but we need to localize them more. And actually, there are all sorts of traditional methods within agriculture that allow you to fertilize soils and so on in a very climate friendly and environmental way, kind of working with working with nature rather than simply trying to control it. And we did a report a few years ago now on agroecology, which is part of this movement. It's being tested and tried in many different places. I mean, it's part of traditional agriculture, but new techniques and new methods are being devised all the time. And it seems that something that should have, you would assume, enormous resources put into it, but of course it doesn't, because all the resources go into the genetic modification and so on. But yeah, it's very frightening. But again, there are solutions out there if as society we chose to put the resources into the developing those solutions.
Thank you. I see we've got Alexander next in the stack.
Also in terms of this producing local, consuming local, and how do you feel can something like this be included in trade? Because I feel like your concept is like, okay, we have the center spot and you want to act like in a radius. The further you get, the less easy it is to trade or something like this. And I mean, on the other hand, some things I just don't make sense to think about this, because some resources are just in certain places. So I don't know what is your take on this.
Yeah, look, I'm not a complete localist. I think you need a balance, basically. And I mean, you know, okay, we do need to change our consumer habits, of course, and maybe one day we will find we have to have less coffee and less bananas and so on. But certainly you can't grow those things here, or you can't grow them without, you know, probably an even more devastating impact on the environment. And so insofar as you do, how can you assist the countries that are doing that growing to produce in a more sustainable way, and how can we transport it in a more sustainable way? There's something very interesting, and I broadly think that Donald Trump has nothing positive to contribute to the world at all. But there is something interesting in the NAFTA renegotiation, and it said this. It said you can import stuff from these factories in Mexico under the preferential tariff that we offer under NAFTA, but only if you pay this amount of money to the workers who work in that factory. That's very interesting. So actually, you can do that. You can apply environmental and worker rights issues to the goods that you give preferential access to under trade deals. That's interesting. Now, you may want to say for certain southern governments, well, certain southern countries, well, it's a bit unfair to make people suddenly adopt standards that we have here in Europe without the resources to do it. You may also want to say, well, okay, so we will help you to do that as well. There will also be a development fund or something like that that can help you get to a certain standard. But that essentially we are turning it around from a race to the bottom to a race to the top. Because I do think trade can help. I mean, trade can deliver know-how and skills that you know, people haven't thought of before, or people haven't developed themselves. That can help to improve the way society operates. But it's just that if you say nothing matters apart from the price at which something is delivered, then the likelihood is that you're pushing standards down rather than just producing a general kind of productivity across society. So I think that's possible. I think it is possible to look at trade preferences and apply environmental and workers' rights and human rights standards to them. And that might be something we want to look at in the future.
100%. Great. Thanks, Nick. Next is Stephanie.
Hi. Apologies again. I'm sorry that I missed so much of your talk, although it sounds I'm familiar with some of the things that I heard you say, so I hope that I didn't miss too much. One very practical thing that I was wondering, in terms of like campaign asks at a national level, what are some of the things that you think would be the most helpful? I happen to be in Italy, doing like Green New Deal work here, and also just, you know, run change.org here. But it's like, the other problem, of course, which is just that it's hard to translate trade asks into something that's sexy enough that a lot of people will participate. But what do you think, like just even like on a, at least a substance level, what would help the most?
It's a really good question. And it's something that we're looking at here. We're applying two Let me say three strands to it. So first of all, there's no question in terms of getting people involved in trade campaigning, having something to oppose is a good thing. Scary trade deals are something that we know can get people onto the streets. And honestly, TTIP did so much for trade campaigning. It allowed so many people in our society to get their head around what trade meant nowadays. And from that, we've been able to keep the momentum going and form trade groups around the country and so on. For us here in the UK, we're fighting against the US trade deal at the moment. But actually, the EU is also talking to the US, and many of these things would also be being pushed in the talks that that the Commission is having with Trump at the moment. So that might be something and some way to continue fighting. The problem at the moment is they've not called it a formal trade deal. They're just negotiations, but it's going to have exactly the same stuff in it. So I think being able to mobilize people around that could be a very helpful first step. The second thing we're doing is trying to call for more democracy, transparency, and accountability for trade policy. One of the reasons trade policy is used by decision makers is it's normally done behind closed doors, right? We don't have the same democratic leverage over trade deal that we do over any other bit of public policy. And because trade deals are so expansive nowadays, I think we've really got to fight for that. I mean, it must be said, European accountability mechanisms are some of the strongest in the world now. Because of TTIP, they were improved a lot. MEPs now get a vote on the final deal. They can see the papers and so on and so forth. But fighting for that is really important. And we've definitely found for activists, getting people excited about trade secrecy is something you can do. I mean, people do not like things being negotiated in their name that they can't know anything about. So that's the second thing. And the third thing I found that works a bit is having, and this is a little bit abstract for people, and I get that, but people do seem to get into the spirit of it in a great way. Actually having these discussions about what an alternative trade policy would look like and coming up with their own manifesto for a trade policy and how we can reform trade rules and so on. It's difficult because, of course, it's a long way from the individual's life. It's, just negotiating trade is quite a long way up the spectrum. But despite that, we found really interesting discussion circles and so on. And we've even had trade justice groups around the country that are most interested in this question of how we can reform trade rules. So that's a little bit more abstract. But I think there's definitely a section of society that are interested in this. We are part of ATTAC, so we are related to ATTAC France, and I think there's an ATTAC Italy and so on as well. And they're quite interested in having those kind of conversations. Normally you can get the most people mobilized, of course, when there's something very imminent that you're fighting against. And it's then how you take that. And I have to say, I mean, some of this stuff, you think, wow, how are we going to change that? I mean, that is just so big. The forces we're fighting against here are so enormous. For me, TTIP just showed that we can win. I mean, right, that was something where we had almost no politicians on our side, almost no media on our side at the beginning. I mean, I would go into meetings with them, with members of parliament, and they wouldn't believe what I was saying. And within just a couple of years, we changed it. We changed and controlled the narrative from grassroots movements, and we stopped it. And we've stopped someone put on the list there, ACTA, absolutely. We stopped it at the MAI back in the 90s, the Multilateral Agreement on Investment, very similar to TTIP. We halted WTO talks for 10 years, and they couldn't do anything. So although it's very far away from us in some ways, in other ways, actually, our campaign history on trade has been quite successful.
Wow. Thank you, Nick. We have another question, Alexander Stack, for the phone number that we have in our group.
Yeah, he's just for me. He asked me on Telegram. I think he's there under the name Dia Alianga. Sorry. Are you hearing us? Because because you're muted. Can you say something, dear?
I am unmuted, yes?
Ah, yeah, now yes, you're unmuted.
Can you. Okay. I can talk now.
Yes, thanks.
Okay. You've been talking about the effect of global trade on the global south countries. And we have here in Europe some regions in Martinique and Guadeloupe that belongs to this paradigm, I mean, global south, in terms of the historical conditions inherited from slavery and colonial trade. And since now, there's still problem around claw bacon issues. And you also have been talking about indigenous people from Canada, I guess. And I don't know if there is tools concerning environmental justice that can be used for those people, since the conditions are not exactly the same, and maybe I don't got it right, but I wanted to know if some besides ecocide, if there is other tools that can be used. I've heard about patrimonicide back in the days. I don't know if I got myself clear.
Yes.
I made myself clear, pardon.
Yes, I think so. And I didn't talk enough probably about the Global South, and one of the reasons for that is at the moment, I suppose, where I'm coming from, our government is doing all sorts of trade deals with other developed countries. So my focus is a little bit there, even though I'm supposed to be talking about the Global South. But yes, you're absolutely right. And reforming the terms of trade isn't just an environmental issue either. I mean, for those countries that you're talking about, you know, they desperately need rebalanced economies. And they've been told, you know, under the theory of free markets and free trade for decades now, well, you don't worry about any of that. What's your comparative advantage? And it turns out, surprise, surprise, their comparative advantage is selling something extremely low value to the rich world. And the rich world, we process and manufacture and create services that are more valuable, and we sell it back. And this perpetuates global inequality. So you're absolutely right. The additional powers that governments need to deal with climate change, they also need to rebalance their economies. And this is absolutely vital. But we need that push coming from southern countries too. And there are trade networks, there are trade justice campaigns and so on in some of those countries. There is a Latin American trade network, there's an African trade network that groups together different countries and different. But we need that too, and to work in solidarity with them. And I have some links and so on maybe I can share later for those, some of those campaigns.
Merci. Yeah. It will be possible to have the links and contact maybe with some solidarities working in this field.
Yes, I will share some links. Yes, I will share some links maybe with Alexander or someone later.
Thank you very much.
Merci. Oh, great question. Thank you. Next up, we have Janos.
Yeah, can I? I'd like to return to those international trade deals, because I think they are a big issue and they are a big obstacle in the new green policy. Do you think this is something that the European Union should focus on to revise those trade deals? Because I think individual countries are not able to do anything about that. What do you think about it?
Yes, I think when it comes to trade policy, the European Union normally has the mandate anyway, so it would have to be that like that. But of course, the countries still play an important role in pushing for what the policy is going to be at the European level. There's been some very interesting stuff in the last week or two from France and the Netherlands, which goes a little bit beyond the traditional ineffective sustainability chapters. They've actually said something a little bit more interesting. We'll see where they get. I am skeptical, of course, but still, I still welcome initiatives that might go some way to being able to change these rules. And look, I think the European Union really and truthfully has an extremely important role at this time, because what we see with Trump I mean, who knows what will happen in the United States in the fall. But with Trump, we see somebody who wants to rip up the rules that we've got at the moment, not in order to create a more environmentally friendly a set of rules, but just in order to beggar my neighbor even more. You know, a kind of almost mercantilist, you know, only one of us can win and it's going to be me. A bullying set of international trade standards, and for me, I think we're really in danger of losing any kind of international system, and some in the world say, well, okay, it's so bad, maybe that's not the worst thing. For me, I think it can be worse, and I think figures like Trump will make it worse. And so, if you want to recreate a better international system, actually, the European Union is one of the most important forces in the world today to do that. Now, politically, it's not in a place where it is pushing that very hard. But maybe with this crisis in the international system, finally, we can talk to some of these politicians and say, look, you want internationalism and I want internationalism. There may be a different form of rules that we think would be ideal. But you have to see at this stage that the rules you've pushed, the neoliberal free market rules that you've pushed, have got us to this point. And if you want international cooperation, we need a very different sort of rule. I've been reading some Polanyi recently and reminding myself of his critique of what happened in the 1930s and the way that, you know, there were a bunch of people in the center of politics who were so unprepared to accept anything other than the free market rules that they believed in that they opened the door for fascism. Because they weren't prepared to countenance a reform in international rules. And I think we've got to bring this up with people again and say, look, this is, you want international cooperation. You don't want to go down the kind of nationalist Trump route. You need to listen to some of what we're saying about how the global economy needs to be seriously and radically reformed.
Yep. Yes to everything. Wow, so interesting. Are there any other questions? Maybe Vladimir? Alexander, okay.
So in terms of organizing, so I mean, we're like in DiEM and the Green New Deal and so on and so forth, it's like very important to find a way to organize people, but also to get in contact with organizations that might be along the same line or that we can work with. And for me, one of the obvious organizations would be unions. And so I was wondering, like, what is your take on why the unions haven't managed to do that? Is there like this self-interest that keeps them away? Is this communication? Is this like just a mindset?
So I have very different experiences in this area. So broadly, when we've been fighting the US trade deal, the unions have been very on side with us in Britain. You tend to find that unions across Europe develop something of a kind of a national cultural preference or economic preference that their government. So in Scandinavia, the unions are very free trade because Scandinavian countries have always been free trade. Interestingly, there's a thinker called Danny Roderick, an economist who I definitely recommend people take a look at. And he says, okay, Scandinavians have made free trade kind of work for them. How have they done it? They've recognized that free trade has losers as well as winners, and that if you want free trade to work for your society, you need strict regulations, you need a welfare state to protect people who are going to lose out from trade, and you need to redistribute the benefits that come from trade so everybody in society benefits. Now, a country like Britain hasn't done that. It's said we love free trade, but then it's been completely free market, no regulation, nothing like that. So, you know, the opposite of that. So if you want open markets, that actually doesn't mean you want less regulation. It means you need more regulation to make those open markets actually work. But I think across Europe, there's very different, you know, traditionally France is much less free trade, Scandinavia much more so. And the unions tend to reflect some of that thinking, I think, in the way that they work. And of course, as you find across the piece, unions are worried about jobs first and foremost, of course. So it's the same when we talk about green transition, right? It's the same when we talk about fossil fuels. It takes quite a lot to shift them, and so they feel comfortable in the space. So we have been doing that work with fairly good results. Sometimes you'll hit a stumbling block, but I absolutely agree with you. I think they're key partners and allies in this work. So talking to them about this is really very important. But I also think an awful lot of environmental campaigners and social justice campaigners can be brought into this space as well. And one of the things we were planning to do this year, which this would have fit in very well with, of course, there was the COP proposed for Glasgow. And we wanted to do a lot of work with campaigners to say, look, if we believe in climate justice, if this isn't just about, you know, saving climate change, stopping climate change by any means necessary, but thinking about the whole way that it interacts with power and the global economy and these different structures, then we need to really get this message out and make trade and the global economy one of the big points of the mobilization around COP this year. So now that's been kicked into next year, we think. So we will continue trying to do that with grassroots groups on the ground and say this is a really important role where we can begin, and we need to begin having these conversations. So we were going to do that here in Britain. I would love to do more of this in at a European level too, and indeed an international level. The thing I found is, and maybe this is a great forum for overcoming this, you have trade networks and you have environmental networks. And the two sides talk to each other a bit, but they're not really integrated. And how do we integrate this conversation? And for me, this is one of the great thing about what you guys are doing. It tries to integrate and provide a forum for lots of these different issues coming together. So I don't have the answer as to how we could do that, how we could do more joint discussions and potentially joint mobilizations around this kind of thing. But I desperately think it needs to happen, because otherwise climate change becomes this thing, this silo over here. Trade policy is this silo over here. And we are unable to come up with a common analysis, much less bring people out in the streets and protest and campaign on a holistic vision.
Great, thank you. Yeah, that also is in the back of my mind, is how to reach out to the common man, so to speak. Vladimir, do you have a question?
Not exactly. I'm here to learn, to listen and learn, because I'm not a activist. I mean, not a green activist, but I'm sort of an organizer. Because green eco-activists in Macedonia are really fucked up in their minds. Actually, over a year ago, I joined Fridays for Future. Brice Montagne introduced me to Fridays for Future. And on 29th of November, I used this Fridays for Future campaign, or world campaign, to unite the Greens in Macedonia. But we had like 100 demands for the government. All of them were accepted, but none was realized. Actually, this front of around 40 eco organizations, within maybe less than a month, it all collapsed because people are so fucked up. I mean, so crazy. The most important thing is not to get the job done, but to be the most important or the most clever of all. So I'm here just to learn from your from other people's experience in other countries in order to get the job done. So I'm not an expert in any kind of or any part of ecology. I'm just here, but I know what is true. I know that here we are a dumpyard of some foreign companies. They're burning here, even they're importing RDF, this from Italy. I know that it's the pollution is high, very high here in Skopje, because they're burning some illegal materials. The whole system is collapsed. So, but from the normal people are supposed to be better organized in order to get the truth out. So I'm going to fight. I think that the Green New Deal is I read almost half of it. I think it's a very good material now because of the Corona crisis, and now we're going to hit hard the economy in economy crisis. But one more thing: everything that you have in in EU countries or UK. Everything in ascending countries is the same, but on a level of 300 euros salary. You have a maybe average like 800, maybe 1,000, but here is on a 300, and the prices are more or less the same. Plus, from the collapse of Yugoslavia, we are living in a, some kind of neo-colonialism, neo-feudalism, and plus some kind of stabilocracy that EU is here, stability over rule of law. And it's all how to say, patron, like EU EU ambassadors and maybe some of politicians are patrons of our politicians here. So because I am seeing that the same scenario is happening that happened in Macedonia is happening in Serbia. They're 2 or 3 years late only. I don't know how to say. Even we have a runaway prime minister that was prime minister 2006 until 2016. He is convicted, but he ran away to Hungary to his friend Viktor Orban. But nobody in the EU is speaking about that. So he's a fugitive from the justice, but he is hiding in the EU country. And he made like, I think he gave 80 concessions to 80 mines here. Like, and we are a country, I don't know, less than Belgium, like, I don't know, something like, we have like 25,000 square kilometers, 80 new mines, they have concessions to mine. So we're, I don't know what to say, whatever you can, whatever is not imaginable here happens. So that's why I'm here, just to learn and to in order to, how to deal with the situation with people, etc., etc. So I'm not going to ask questions. Everything is new for me, and I will be just like a sponge, just taking information, and that's it. Okay, thank you.
I think we have just taken a good lesson of what is happening in some parts of Europe, which is not considered global south, but still within Europe we have such big problems. So thank you very much, Vladimir, for that.
Thank you, Vladimir. I agree 100%, and we're all learning. I'm in the same boat, but I thank you for your comments, and we all stand with you 100%, and we hope that this Green New Deal will be a way, a mechanism to bring about at least some change. And we're with you 100% as DM members as well. Next in the stack, we have Alexander.
I didn't stack, but...
Maybe that's older.
That's the old stack, yeah.
Oh, but that's the old stack, okay.
Maybe to pass one... one point is, I heard recently about BlackRock and changing a little bit there, and I don't know who is not knowing it. I didn't know before, so it's like a really huge investment company. It's like moving around billions of dollars and euros, and they have like huge parts of shares of companies. And like one thing I heard about them, that they are kind of starting to see global climate change and environmental destruction as a threat to their investment. And I found this, I don't know, some sort of irony in that, so that they are kind of, at least to a degree, pushing the company, saying like, look, we have to change something. And if you're not following this kind of set of principles or something, we want to do something, or we're not gonna allow that. I don't know if that's something that you heard about. Do you have a feeling that this is going to change something important?
I mean, I think when I first got to the organization I work at now, we were working on trying to get the banks to disinvest from coal, but fossil fuels more generally. I never thought this would work in a realistic time frame that I would, that I would see while I was at the organization. It's working, right? And that's amazing, right? So I think really some of this stuff is a tribute to campaigners who've been pushing for this, like TTIP, against the most incredible odds, and actually some of them have just seen, okay, this is going to be a real issue. We're going to have a load of stranded assets that we can't use here, because we've seen the campaigns beginning to work. We've seen government regulations starting to change. We've seen the shutdown of long-term of these industries' profitability. And so, I think it's the result of a lot of campaigning as opposed to them taking a particularly pioneering stance. But of course, welcome. What worries me now, a bit like I was saying at the beginning, is I think a lot of these big investors, big corporations are saying, okay, cut our losses. We see that there's few profits to be made from coal, and maybe oil is, you know, getting into that territory, although I'm a bit more skeptical about that. But however, we want to recreate as much as we can a global economy that looks like it does now, just without coal, just without oil. And of course, for us, this is a big problem, because we don't just want to halt climate change. We want a fairer world and a more sustainable economy. And I think there's an environmental aspect to that too, because if we don't have that, many countries are going to continue to be so screwed that environmental protection doesn't really mean anything, right? Because you're still chopping down forests. You're still, it's the lack of sustainability that's really the problem. And so creating an extremely unequal global economy just based on things other than fossil fuels is also a problem for us. And so for me, that's why this is the time to put forward the kind of sustainable economy we want long term onto the political agenda, onto the economic agenda, and to be skeptical. I mean, let's take victories where we can, right? If some of the big financiers and so on are saying, no, we see this is, then I didn't expect that 5 or 6 years ago. So that's incredible, and we should be pleased, and that proves we can begin to change things. But I also think let's demand more than that. Let's demand a complete change in the way that these companies operate, because at the end of the day, the amount of assets under the control of a company like BlackRock is in and of itself a massive problem. I mean, the influence that they have over the markets and so on. I mean, essentially what we've done over the last 30, 40 years is we've taken economic planning out of governments, where at least there's the possibility that you can make it more democratic. It's not always more democratic, but there's a possibility you can make it more democratic. And we have handed it over to financial markets. And that's what companies like BlackRock represent today. They represent economic planning, but on, with no public interest whatsoever at the heart of their model. And so I think this is a great opportunity to challenge the power that they've got in the world and the economic model that we've got, as well as where various companies are investing.
Can I ask a question? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think yes. Yeah, you can go.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of the role that the European Commission could play, but we don't know whether it will. But the European Green Deal, or whatever is its name, I think I can see that as a good starting point for a transition. Of course, we are not quite happy with the content, because it's far from the needs and from our expectations. But it is a good starting point, and I think we should defend that from the forces that are against any Green Deal, and then add our knowledge, our ideas, and our expectations to transform the Green Deal by European Commission to make it really work. But at this point, I think the major issue is if it really kicks off. Let us make it kicked off first, and then and defend it, but in the same time contribute our ideas to it. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's a question as much for the other participants on the call as me. I mean, you know, I'm in the strange situation now of not having any leverage over the European Commission at all. And probably British activists is the last thing they want to listen to. But but your broad approach, of course. I mean, look, I think when people are talking on your kind of language and using your framework, even if they're not calling for what you're calling for, it gives you an amazing moment, an amazing scope. I remember back in the, you know, I got really active in the anti-globalization movement, and we were talking about trade all the time and governments, and it was very helpful in mobilizing people in our society. We disagreed a lot with what the government was saying, but the fact that we were talking about, the fact we were on, we were using the same words, the fact we were talking about the same kind of general areas of the world and society massively helped and gave us a lot more leverage. So I think, you know, it's just a great time. And a great opportunity to be pushing. And of course, I mean, I constantly say when I'm talking about trade, you know, don't think just because Donald Trump is doing it differently means it's better, or don't think just because this system is so bad means it can't get any worse. Those things can happen too. And in some ways, I think, you know, it's I don't know what words people like using, but it's socialism or barbarism is a relevant concept today. If we don't have a really radical change in the way our society operates, I really fear for the future. So of course you want to defend certain democratic institutions and so on from attack by the far right. At the same time, if they don't reform and if we aren't playing a role in reforming them, they will collapse anyway.
Good points. Thank you, Jonas. We have a stack from Alexander for
Dear. So your microphone is unmuted.
I have a question concerning a statement you just made, talking about the global south existing in Europe. Then I thought about something and I want to ask the question. Do you consider neoliberalism as dangerous as colonialism back in the day? A kind of colonialism against Europe and the global economy.
Yeah, I think it is as dangerous in some. I mean, it's an economy that preserves some of the processes and relationships of colonialism in some ways. Yeah, and I think if you look at the time neoliberalism was really, I don't know, invented, created. You know, it was the Third World Debt Crisis in the late 1970s that allowed neoliberalism to be imposed on many countries. And, you know, they were directly colonial relationships, the IMF and the World Bank suddenly bailing out the banks, having all of this debt owed to them and using that leverage to dictate their economic policies direct from Washington. They were the first victims of this. And I think it's no coincidence that it was a time when many countries in the global south were arguing for something radically different, a radically different form of politics at a global level. You know, the new international economic order was passed at the United Nations in 1975. It would have been a remarkably different path over the last 40 or 50 years if that had got more sway. And the Third World Debt Crisis was used to undermine that and create this new kind of highly financialized economic system that in many ways replicated colonial relationships of the decades preceding it. So, you know, whether it's better or worse, it's different. But there are big similarities, and I think it's about power and it's about control. To be honest, trade has always been about power and control. It's always about exacerbating those relationships. Globally, I mean, my government talks about the heyday of free trade in the 19th century, and free trade for the British government meant bombarding Chinese ports and blowing up palaces until they accepted our opium exports into the country. That was free trade.
Thank you very much.
Well said, and totally agree. It's just another form of holding workers as slaves. any other questions for Nick? before we wrap up, I suppose. I'll hand over to you, Alexander.
You read my mind, I feel. I have as part of this process of webinars and this conversation that we have, and even expanding a little bit our network for the Green New Deal, one important aspect is also for us to expand beyond the English-speaking sphere. So maybe something that, I don't know if you will be able to answer this now, or something maybe that we can later talk about, like via email, is if you like have some suggestions how we can get in contact with people that share these principles, share these ideals in other languages. So, yeah.
That'll help us spread the word, yeah.
Definitely. So I know some people definitely in Latin America who are Spanish speakers, who we work very closely with, so they may be interesting. But also I know people in France particularly who've worked on trade justice issues for a number of years. So I think they may be interesting. And I know some Italian comrades too. So yeah, people we've worked with in the Attack Network and other networks who I'm sure would be interested in contributing and being plugged into some of this stuff. And I can put you in touch if that's useful and interesting, definitely.
That would be amazing, yeah.
Yeah,
definitely
would of course, yeah.
So I don't know if anyone has a final question also. I think I've already asked so much and have to think about everything.
It's so been fascinating. Nick, thanks very much for your discussion, your mini presentation and feedback. It's been amazing. It's opened my mind quite a bit. I didn't know much about trade or any of these things. And now that I've got them on my radar, I'm looking to research on the net and see what's out there. So you've opened my mind a bit. So thank you.
That's brilliant. Oh, it's been a pleasure. It's been really nice. Always nice to talk to people who are interested in
so
trade.
Maybe as a final thing, if you have something that for people that listen to it afterwards that they want to look you up, let's say, or your work, mostly if you have, I don't know, websites, social media or something people can follow up on.
Of course, absolutely. So please go and have a look at globaljustice.org.uk. Global Justice Now is on Facebook and Twitter. And if you want to follow me personally, at NickDearden75 is my Twitter handle. And I try and get back to people on there if you've got more questions or want links or whatever it may be. But certainly our website has a good and detailed trade section, which could at least whet your appetite a bit further for some of these issues.
Excuse me, is it Global Justice, as you said? Yeah.
Yes, Global Justice. Yes, yes.
Thank you. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Also, who is with us on the phone says also thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for all the questions. Great. It was really great discussion.
All right. So,
thank you very much.
Bye.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.